Hey all, welcome back to the Real Life Pharmacology Podcast. I'm your host, pharmacist Eric Christensen. Thanks so much for listening. As always, be sure you check out reallifepharmacology.com. Snag your free 31-page PDF on the top 200 drugs. Great little study guide reference for those folks maybe going through pharmacology classes, or if you've been out in practice for a while and just want a little refresher, make sure you're staying up to date. Definitely a cool little resource to check out, and it's free, absolutely free for subscribing. All right, so let's talk about the drug of the day today. Medication is cyanocobalamin, which is vitamin B12. Now, some may not consider this a medication per se, since it is a supplement and a nutritional intake type of thing. But I do, and you know, the reason being is that we certainly can dose it, and obviously it can be used to treat deficiency. And there are a bunch of medications, or a few medications, that I definitely look out for when I see an order for B12. And I'll talk about that as I wrap up the podcast later in drug interactions for sure. So, what is vitamin B12 used for? What's it good for in the body? The most common indication I would say I see in practice is pernicious anemia. Now, what is, you know, pernicious anemia compared to, you know, generalized anemia? Well, pernicious anemia specifically involves lack or low amounts of intrinsic factor. Now, what's intrinsic factor? Well, intrinsic factor aids in the absorption, or is necessary for gut absorption of B12. So, in patients that don't have this intrinsic factor, odds are likely they're not getting enough B12 in their diet through their food because they can't absorb it that well through the gut because they don't have this intrinsic factor or an inadequate amount of intrinsic factor. So, long story short, these are the patients that you're likely going to see on injectable once monthly B12 injections, okay? So those with vitamin B12 deficiency due to pernicious anemia, likely going to be a lifelong administration of that B12 by the injectable route. Now, there is a nasal route available as well. That could potentially be utilized to substitute that. At this time, I believe it's way, way more expensive. Don't quote me on that, but last I checked, I believe it was way more expensive than the injectable. But something to potentially look into if you've got a patient that absolutely will not, you know, do injections or whatever the case may be. So anyway, that's pernicious anemia. One of the, you know, complications of B12 deficiency is obviously those symptoms of anemia, fatigue. You know, you get that kind of pale-looking skin, just tired all the time, that type of thing. Other potential complications that I've seen from B12 deficiency, neuropathy can happen with B12 deficiency. So when I see a new order for, you know, gabapentin or pregabalin, one of the things that I'm thinking about is this a drug-induced neuropathy, or is this a deficiency-induced neuropathy where maybe that B12 deficiency is caused by another medication? In my geriatric patient population, if B12 deficiency is severe enough, it could lead to cognitive changes, and this can be permanent in some cases too. So definitely keep that in mind. And often in a patient that is experiencing, you know, new memory lapses, I'll see providers order you know, B12 with TSH as well as a whole bunch of other lab work. So definitely an important thing to think about there. There is another term I wanted to mention associated with anemia, and you'll often hear the term megaloblastic anemia, and that basically refers to the size of the red blood cells. They actually become larger, and you'll see that in the labs. You'll see an elevated MCV, And B12 is one of the possible diagnoses from an elevated MCV. Another supplement I'm not going to talk about today, but folic acid can cause megaloblastic anemia as well. And then iron is typically considered to cause more of a microcytic anemia. All right, so let's talk about some disease states where B12 supplementation may be indicated or might be a good reason why we would need supplementation. So types of inflammatory bowel disease where maybe our absorption isn't that good, such as Crohn's, for example. Gastric bypass surgery, where we've actually maybe removed or bypassed certain areas of the gut there. We may have a reduced absorption through the gut of B12 there. Alcoholism, obviously patients with, eating disorders or they're severely malnourished. Again, maybe some of those dementia patients that aren't eating well or they forget to eat. Those are types of situations where chronic B12 supplementation may be indicated, as well as the pernicious anemia, which I mentioned before there too. Lab monitoring, so, usual B12 levels, 150 to up to 900 is considered normal. That's picograms per mil. I've seen some labs, I think, report out a lower end of like 200. So that target and where we want that level to be might be a little bit variable based upon what the patient has going on. For instance, we may target a little higher level if they've had, gastric surgeries, or we know they're at risk or prone to not getting much absorption through the gut and through their dietary intake. So again, that kind of target goal can vary a little bit. The ballpark normal lab is, low end is 150 to 200, somewhere in that range. Administration, I think I kind of alluded to that a little bit. Particularly with pernicious anemia or gut problems, we're not going to get adequate absorption. So that's where you're going to often see sub-Q IM injections of B12. Oral absorption can be variable. And so if a patient has significant B12 deficiency, we're likely going to try to avoid oral just because, we may not be 100% sure that we're getting adequate absorption. Now, if somebody's kind of borderline, that type of thing, it might be, and they don't really have any symptoms or anything, that might be a situation where maybe we do start oral and kind of watch the B12 level and obviously monitor them clinically for any symptoms of B12 deficiency there. All right, so let's take a quick break, and I will finish up with drug interactions. If you're in the market for pharmacist board certification study materials like BCPS, ambulatory care, geriatrics, MTM, NAPLEX exam, definitely go check out meded101.com/store. If you're another healthcare provider just looking for some practice pearls, maybe a book to kind of help stimulate your thought process on how to manage and deal with medications. Again, we've got links to Amazon books. There's a free Audible book promotion you can take advantage of as well if you've never had an Audible book in the past. So definitely go check out all those resources. Any financial support there is going to help with the keep producing the podcast and help keep it free and educational for all to enjoy and benefit from. All right, so let's take a peek at drug interactions. Now, vitamin B12 itself isn't typically going to cause any issues with, other medications for the most part. And if you think about it, it's like, well, it's in your diet, it's in food, and so it's like, the odds of it causing a lot of issues with a lot of medications is pretty low there. However, I did want to touch on medications that affect B12 because there are actually some really, really common drugs that can lower B12 levels, and we should be aware of this. So the first one's a diabetes medication, metformin. one of the most commonly used first-line medications for type 2 diabetes. Metformin can actually lower B12 levels. So in a patient that has diabetes, they say they're reporting neuropathy. Well, it could be diabetic neuropathy. That's a very plausible concern. But it also, if they're on metformin, it also could be related to B12 deficiency. So again, very, very important that we think about that and make sure that we're monitoring for that risk with metformin. Another really common class, I guess a generalized class, is antacid type medications, and more specifically PPIs and H2 blockers. So your omeprazole is probably the most common, PPI. Famotidine is a common H2 blocker. These drugs actually have been associated with B12 deficiency. So in anybody that's obviously displaying B12 deficiency symptoms, I'm going to take a look at that med list and say, hey, what are we on that PPI for? What are we on that H2 blocker for? It may absolutely be necessary. They may have, GI bleeding issues or something like that. But it's a good time to stop and take a look and say, hey, do they really need this antacid therapy long term, or can we start to try to taper down on that, which may help us avoid B12 deficiency and or the need for another medication or another supplement to potentially manage a potential side effect there. So metformin, PPIs, H2 blockers. The last specific medication, prescription medication, I wanted to mention was colchicine. So this is used in gout flares. I've done a podcast on this medication as well as the others in the past. But if you know a patient's taking chronic colchicine, that could potentially lead to B12 deficiency. Now, if somebody gets it for 3 days for an acute, 5 days, 7 days for an acute gout flare, probably not something I'm going to worry about too much as far as B12 deficiency. But again, chronic use, I'm definitely going to be paying a little bit closer attention. And if they're obviously displaying some symptoms that could be related to B12 deficiency. And lastly, not necessarily a medication per se, but I do want to mention alcohol. So, heavy alcohol use does and is associated with B12 deficiency. So patients who have a history of alcoholism, often you'll see these patients on B12 supplementation to make sure they don't get too low there. All right, so that's going to wrap up the podcast for today. If you enjoyed the show, share us with a colleague, a friend, student. Also, leave a rating on iTunes or wherever you're listening. I'm greatly appreciative to those of you who have done so. Go check out reallifepharmacology.com. Get that free top 200 study guide. Absolutely no cost to you. We'll also get you updates regarding new content and things we have going on too. I mentioned, alluded to, talking about the prescribing cascade and doing a new book surrounding that with, case studies and all sorts of medication-related pearls in there. So that'll be coming. Obviously, if you're a subscriber at reallifepharmacology.com, you'll get the update on that. And I do give a huge discount once that book is released. So as cheap as they'll let me price it is usually what I try to do initially for the people that are the biggest fans and biggest supporters of the podcast here. So keep an eye out for that. I'm anticipating that, maybe in May, June, July, 2021. That's kind of the time frame I'm looking at. If you got comments, suggestions, reach out. You can find me on LinkedIn, or you can track me down by email, mededucation101@gmail.com. All right, I'm going to sign off for today. Thank you guys so much for listening. I hope you have a great rest of your day.